Vance has it. Bounce to Porter. Pow! With two hands.
Wow, how did he get that off? Baisley had the angle on it. Oh, my goodness. What a dunk by Porter.
Rebound loose on the floor. Grabbed by Sexton. Hooked it up, and it rolled around the rim and in.
Another hustle play by Sexton. What a motor.
Ross drives, missed the shot. Out of there with it comes Larry Nance Jr. Vance right in the lane, down the lane. Pow!
Welcome to Cavs HQ, presented by Sherwin-Williams. Thank you for joining us on the Cleveland Cavaliers Radio Network. Now, here are your hosts, Tim Alcorn and Jim Jones.
From the Cavaliers Radio Studios at Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse, hi again, everybody. Welcome to Cavs HQ, presented by Sherwin-Williams. As the man just said, Tim Alcorn, along with my broadcast partner, Jim Jones. Jim, as always, a pleasure to be with you. And, boy, we've got a fun show lined up here for Cavs HQ edition number 3.
Yes, we do, Tim. We've got most of the guys that I've been able to get for us on our great show have been friends off the court as well as on the foot court. But I've known most of these guys for at least 20 years. The reason why I picked this certain kind of player is because these guys are not your superstars, except for McAdoo, who we had last week. But most of these guys are going to be just under the radar. The only thing that kept them from getting more visibility, probably there was no social media. That's where we are, Tim. But stay tuned, fans.
Yeah, we've got a great guest coming up. What the heck? I'll let folks know. Bobby Dandridge, one of the all-time greats in the NBA. We look forward to talking with Bobby Dandridge. And then a little bit later on in the show, we'll hear from one of the longtime voices in the NBA. Mark Boyle, the Indiana Pacers radio play-by-play guy, will join us. So we're going to have a fun time. Stay with us. It's Cavs HQ, presented by Sherwin-Williams. We'll be back when Bobby D will join us. So stay with us. Welcome back to Cavs HQ, presented by Sherwin-Williams. Tim Alcorn, along with Jim Jones, and yes, settling into that Legends chair. It's comfortable. He'll enjoy it, and we will enjoy this conversation. You talk about another NBA legend that Jim Jones has lined up in that black book of his, Bobby Dandridge. Boy, what a career this man had in the NBA. 13-year career, 9 with Milwaukee, 4 with Washington, 2-time NBA champion, 4-time All-Star, and a lot more to talk about as we will roll along with Bobby Dandridge. But Bobby, it's great to have you on the show, and certainly we look forward to talking about your career and some of the things that are happening in the NBA.
Well, I appreciate you thinking about me, and it is a privilege to be able to sit in a Legends chair.
It's comfortable, isn't it? You're comfortable, right, in the Legends chair?
I can hold that down and get comfortable in that seat.
All right. Now, before I let you get rolling with Jim here, because I know you two will probably have a lot to talk about, I went over some of the things in your remarkable NBA career. What I didn't mention, you were a fourth-round draft pick in 1969 of the Milwaukee Bucks. The number one overall pick that year was Lew Alcindor, who, of course, became Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. So Kareem goes number one overall, and you're a fourth-round pick out of a D2 school. Who found you at Norfolk State?
Well, I averaged 32 a game my senior year in college, so somebody, even if they just looked at the D2 stats, would have seen it. But, going to Milwaukee, and I think I was about the 45th or 46th person picked in the draft that year. And actually, they drafted another small forward ahead of me. A guy named Bob Greason, and the first day in camp, second day in camp, he twisted his ankle, and the rest was history. He didn't get a chance to recover.
Hey, Bobby, I remember. Yeah, Bobby, I remember Greason. because they tried to build him up. And then everybody that I had talked to was talking about this guy named Bobby Dandridge. And I said, Bobby Dandridge, where's he from? He said, Norfolk State. I said, oh, okay. Because there were guys from Division II and black historical colleges and black schools ahead of you. Of course, the great Zelmo Beatty, Dick Barnett, and that's just to name a few.
Yeah.
But out of all of those guys, I've always thought that you and Earl, take your pick depending on what style of play you like, you and Earl Monroe were the best I've ever seen.
Yeah. Well, we got to remember Sam Jones came from
that's
a historically
right.
black school.
Yes,
Willis sir. Reed did also.
Yep.
So at least every year there were at least two guys from historically black schools that were making it in the league. And I must say that I was fortunate when I went to Milwaukee. Number one, they were only the second year in existence. The year before, they were expansion team. And I was fortunate that a guy like Larry Costello was coaching because he saw that I was a fundamentally sound guy. And one of the big things that I had going for me when I went to Milwaukee was I knew how to feed the post. I knew how to throw the ball to whatever hand Kareem was holding up. I could throw a bounce pass. And so, you know, it was just the basic fundamentals that Larry Costello saw in me that allowed me to stay in Milwaukee.
But, you know, Bobby, you know, you said something there that just brought a light on in my old mind. When I was with the Lakers, the only people that could throw Kareem the right kind of pass was me or Magic. And so anytime we want to throw it in, people take it for granted that, oh, he's so big, you just throw it in. No, it isn't. You have to remember, he wasn't very strong physically, but he was strong enough to play and dominate. But as far as holding position, if you had to make him move off that spot, you really took a lot of his advantage away if it wasn't the right kind of pass. I remember that because I remember Coach McKinney. And I think you might have had Coach McKinney for a minute.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. And he used to tell me, he said, I wish I had more guys that knew how to get Kareem the ball besides you and Magic. And I looked at him, and then I thought about it. I said, you know what? That is an art in itself and a fundamental.
Oh, yeah.
Bobby, I want to ask you real quick. You're coming in as a fourth-round draft pick out of a D2 school. I'm sure there were some nerves, some anxiety, but at what point did you realize, hey, I can play with these guys. I can play in the NBA. At what point do you remember that the off factor may have worn off a little bit?
Well, I think probably the second day in camp, you know, when the veterans tend to gravitate towards you and tend to start giving you little clues. And my big thing was that during my summers at Norfolk State, I would always go through D.C., Philadelphia, and Atlantic City and play basketball. And at that time, I would play against guys that were in the pros. So by the time I went to Milwaukee, I knew that the pros weren't, you know, I just was not in awe of them.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I'd even go to say that probably in that year draft, there must have been about nine other forwards, small forwards that were drafted ahead of me. And my career ended up being longer and more distinguished than any of those other nine or ten. So when I went to Milwaukee, I had a lot of confidence in my game. And I could play defense, I could shoot, and I could just play all phases of the game. And about my second day in camp, a guy named Guy Rogers took a liking to me, and Guy Rogers was just a tremendous passer. And I could make him look good because I can get out on the fast break. And I could get open and get shots. And I think that when you go to a training camp, it doesn't take the veterans long to identify that you can play. And that happened to me probably at least my second day in rookie camp.
Wow.
So by the time, I think rookie camp was in June. The funny story was that on the third, by the third or fourth day of rookie camp, they were going to put up a list of guys that they were going to invite back to veteran camp. And, you know, all the rookies, we were afraid, and I went into practice that morning, and the trainer, guy Arnie Garber, he had a big old bag off to the side. And so he said, well, how are you feeling about making the list today? I said, well, we won't know for another 2 hours, will we? And so he said, well, look, I'm going to let you off the hook. And here's your bag to take home full of practice gear and an NBA basketball. And so, you know, it didn't take me long to sort of make an impression on everybody with the Bucks organization. So being a fourth-round draft choice coming from a D2 school, you know, I really wasn't in awe of my playing skills. I just was fortunate that Milwaukee did not have a bunch of no-cut contracts.
Oh,
and,
good point.
You know, in fact, I started from day one, started the first game, which was televised, and it wasn't televised because of me. It was televised because everybody wanted to see Lou Alcindor play his first game.
Yeah, you weren't the marquee attraction there, there's no doubt.
Oh, no.
No offense, Bob, no offense.
Oh, no. Hey, look. Like you said, I was just glad to be on the squad.
Tell you what, we got to take a quick timeout, and when we come back, we're going to hear some more great stories. Bobby Dandridge, boy, an NBA legend, has settled comfortably, no doubt, into that legend's chair on Cavs HQ, presented by Sherwin-Williams. Welcome back to Cavs HQ, presented by Sherwin-Williams. Boy, we're having a great conversation with NBA legend Bobby Dandridge. Now, I'm going to throw a trivia question out there for our Cavs listeners. The answer is going to be obvious because of our guest, but I never would have known this, and I'm going to win a beverage on this sometime. Who holds the NBA record for most points in the NBA Finals in the 1970s? Bobby Dandridge. You know, I have to admit, I didn't know that off the top of my head, Bobby. I did a little research. You think about the great...
Neither did I.
Well, that's what the NBA.com said. So you hold the record for the most points in the NBA Finals in the decade of the 70s. Wow. You averaged in the Finals 23 points a game with Milwaukee, and then, of course, you won it with Washington as well with Elvin Hayes and Wes Unseld in that group. So we've been talking a lot about your Milwaukee days. Boy, some quick thoughts on playing with Washington and winning that NBA title with the then Bullets.
You know, that was the first year of free agency in the league. And Washington was one of the teams that I wanted to play with. Because, one, it was only about 100 miles from Richmond, Virginia, where I grew up. But it also gave me the opportunity to maybe compete for another championship again, to play with Wes Unseld and Elvin Hayes. And the Bullets had always been contenders in the East, but they knew they couldn't win the championship without getting past Philadelphia, who had Julius Irvin, McGinnis, and that crew. And I had historically played well against Julius. So they felt comfortable in bringing me to Washington. And Washington gave me an opportunity to practice all the leadership skills that I had seen Kareem and Oscar put on display, knowing when to score, knowing how to motivate a team, knowing how to be a team leader. And at some point, every NBA player who's worth his grain of salt wants to have a team that they can call their own, where, you know, they are the leader, they are the go-to person. And when I went to Washington, I just thought I was going there to fit in and to just contribute. But once I got there, I found out there were bigger expectations of me, and fortunate I got a chance to lead a team with the Bullets, to be the go-to guy and to be the leader. And that's a feeling I think that every player wants to feel, you know, before he leaves the league. And Washington gave me the opportunity to put on display my not only basketball skills, but leadership skills. So I'm forever grateful. Washington allowed me to come out of the shadows because Milwaukee is a great city, but it wasn't the playing in the – In the Midwest was not like being on display on the East Coast against the Celtics, the Knicks, the 76ers, and that time the Hawks. So Washington gave me an opportunity to be Bob Daniels, to be a leader, and to put on display all of my skills. So I'm forever, you know, grateful to Washington for giving me that opportunity.
That's awesome. Jim, we got about a minute left, so one final quick question for Bobby.
Well, Bob, one thing I do want to, you know, I like to ingratiate you guys, and you and I have been friends since I was a senior in high school. I just want to say how much I appreciate your friendship, your direction, and your style of play on and off the court, the way that you act, the way that you're always accessible. All of those fundamental things that sometimes we as former athletes take for granted are what makes up a person's character. And like Wayne Embry used to say, you know, character wins championships. Well, it also wins friends. And we just appreciate you coming and talking to us today, giving us some insight as to your greatness. Now, I've got one wish, and that wish is that within the next year or two, that they make you a Hall of Famer. Tim called me earlier, and he looked at your numbers, and I told him, I looked at those numbers long time ago, and Bobby Dandridge, there's no reason why he's not in the Hall of Fame. But I want to tell you this: when you make it, you better send me an invitation, because I will be there.
Of course.
Wow. Well, Bob
and Tim, you're gonna get one too.
Oh, well, there you go.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, Bobby, this has been awesome. We really appreciate it. And hear your stories and your recollections, it's awesome. I was a big fan of yours when you played, and I'm a bigger fan now that we've had this conversation.
I really appreciate that, and I wish you all the best with your show. And I know can't know everybody sit in that chair, Chum.
That's right.
All right, that's Bobby Dandridge. Again, the numbers
Thank
are just
you,
spectacular. 13 years in the NBA, 2-time NBA champ, 4-time All-Star. What a career. We'll have more on Cavs HQ, presented by Sherwin-Williams, right after this. Welcome back to Cavs HQ, presented by Sherwin-Williams. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver and WNBA Commissioner Kathy Engelbert highlight a list of speakers slated to participate in the free Team Up for Change virtual summit on racial equality and social justice, co-hosted by the Cavaliers along with eight other NBA and WNBA teams on Wednesday, October 21st. Beginning the following day, the Cavs will also host a week of daily engagement sessions through Wednesday, October 28th. The Cavs-led local activations will culminate with a community discussion featuring Emmanuel Acho, former Browns linebacker, current analyst for Fox Sports, and host of the popular video series Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man on the 28th. In addition to special guests such as Silver and Engelbert, attendees will also hear from Cavs GM Kobe Altman, head coach J.B. Bickerstaff, and CEO Len Komrosky. The summit will stream on all participating teams' digital channels. Cavs in the Community, brought to you by Discount Drug Mart. We'll be right back with the second half of Cavs HQ, presented by Sherwin-Williams. Welcome back to Cavs HQ, presented by Sherwin-Williams. Tim Elkhorn, along with Jim Jones, and again, huge thank you to our first guest on this evening's program, Bobby Dandridge. Boy, what an outstanding career he had in the NBA. And the numbers that Jim Jones alluded to, 15,530 points, 5,715 rebounds, 2,846 assists. That is 18.5 points, 7 rebounds, and just under 4 assists per game for Bobby Dandridge. And that was a fun conversation. And now we welcome in another guy that it's going to be a fun conversation to have. He's the longtime radio voice of the Indiana Pacers. Mark Boyle now joins us, 32 years behind the mic as the voice of the Pacers, just under 3,000 games. So you talk about another legend joining us. Mark Boyle, I think you fit that category.
Well, the real story there that you didn't even share was I got the job when I was 6, so I'm not even 40 yet.
All right. Well, listen, it's been a long time as far as some of the NBA fans are concerned that they've kind of recalibrated last season now that it's completely finished. So a quick recap of Indiana before you went to the bubble when things were shut down, 39-26. Then 6-2 in the bubble, so you actually finish up 45-28, and then swept by Miami as you went in as the number 4 seed. But and then of course in August, Nate McMillan and the Pacers part ways. But just your thoughts on the past Indiana Pacers campaign?
Well, I thought it was successful, generally speaking. Something a lot of people aren't aware of is this: when training camp started, their preferred five-man lineup was Malcolm Brogdon, Victor Oladipo, Miles Turner, DeMontis Sabonis, and T.J. Warren. And because of varying injuries, that five-man group played together less than 100 minutes all season long. So
wow.
Injuries were a big problem, and then Sabonis was out, missed the playoffs. And so they never had their team the way they wanted it. Still, they finished, as you said, very impressively with a long distance between themselves and 500. They were dismissed early, perhaps not surprisingly, because of the Sabonis injury. Jeremy Lamb was also out, and Miami had a really good team. So that was disappointing, but not surprising. In the end, though, they decided to go in a different direction, and that's the way the league is now. If a coach lasts longer than 15 minutes, it seems like an eternity.
Now, this has been a lengthy search. I know Kevin Pritchard had said, and that's your president of basketball ops, they're going to look at all options and all sorts of scenarios. How close do you think the organization is to finally naming that person as the next head coach of the Pacers?
It's really hard to say because, A, the organization here, generally speaking, has been pretty good at keeping their business in-house when they've tried to find a new coach or had any major decisions like that. This goes back to when Larry Bird ran it, when it was almost impossible to get any information out of there. And then, B, with the pandemic, we don't have the contact that we normally have. On a normal summer, I might pop into the office 3 or 4 times a month and then stick my head into the office. And it's not like they consult me or even care what I think, but you'll pick up bits and pieces of knowledge. But all of that's in the past now because we don't see these people anymore. So I have no idea where they're at with it, but I know they've been very, very serious about finding the right guy. Who's to say who that is? But in his Zoom conference after the announcement of Nate's firing, Kevin was very complimentary of Nate, but did say on more than one occasion in that conference he wanted to find somebody who was adept at communicating with the modern player, which doesn't necessarily narrow the field, but it does lead you to think that maybe they're going to go with somebody younger and less traditional, but we'll see.
Again, we're talking with Mark Boyle, longtime voice of the Indiana Pacers, as he joins us on Cavs HQ, presented by Sherwin-Williams. Jim?
Yeah, well, let's talk basketball, Mark. You and I, from time to time, before our games, we sometimes get a chance to talk a little bit. And I've always been amazed about your intellect and your understanding of what this game is all about. You've got a base now, a foundation with Turner, Sabonis, and Warren. And Warren, by the way, he played in the bubble. You know, there's visions of maybe you've got a go-to guy. Maybe you've got a leading scorer now in Warren. But I used to tell Quinn Buckner, if you ever want to get rid of Sabonis, please call Cleveland first. I love Sabonis. Well, you know, I've talked to you about it. I love
you
Sabonis.
Sure have.
I love his play.
Well, he's terrific. And you know the thing about him, Jim, that I like, outside the obvious, all of the things he can do, he's a terrific passer. He's a good shooter. He's strong. He's tough. He gives you the same thing every night. He's not one of these guys that gives you 25 and 15 on Tuesday and then 6 and 4 on Thursday. It's the same every night, and he plays with a great deal of intensity, a great deal of intelligence, and he's really adept at pretty much everything he needs to be good at. I'm not saying he couldn't be had if you had the right offer. Anybody's available. We know that. But it would take a lot to get him out of Indiana. They love him, and I think rightfully so.
Well, you know, another thing, Warren, you know, what happened? I mean, what sparked him to have those two or three outstanding games over and above what anybody could imagine? He was scoring off the dribble. He was making big shots. Why, not having any interference from the outside or distractions? Had you guys considered maybe staying in a bubble in Indianapolis? Because he played like a superstar. But Mark, he played like a superstar.
Yeah, he was really good. Although that was outside the norm for him, it wasn't dramatically so in this regard, Jim. He was their leading scorer coming into the bubble at nearly 20 a game. So
yeah,
he was accomplished, and he was also a good scorer in Phoenix. But as you point out, nothing like what we saw down there in Orlando. He had a 53-point game against Philadelphia and was, generally speaking, their best player every night, particularly without Sabonis on the scene. So they always liked him. They knew he could score, and he demonstrated that over the course of his career. It's interesting, though, the way sometimes your perception can change, and I would throw this back at you and ask you this question. It was impressive. But is 8 games a big enough sample size to conclude this player is a big-time scorer, or is he simply a 19, 20-point-a-game guy that just got hot?
Well, let me answer it like this. I'm not going to answer it, but I'm going to answer it. It's hard playing with a big man who has skills, who has a skill set, and that's Sabonis. It's even harder to play with someone when he's over 6'11", and you've got two of them on the floor. The spacing is different. The emphasis on who they're going to stop, the areas on the floor become more limiting for a guy like Warren who can put it on the dribble, who can go inside or outside. They sort of minimize his possibilities. Now, with no Sabonis in there, and all he had to deal with was Turner, he had space, he had more touches, and that may be the formula for you guys. I mean, I'm impressed. I just think, but I told Quinn, I don't see how you can continue to start Turner and Sabonis. I just don't think you have the floor space to do it offensively.
Well, you're not the first one that's offered that opinion. They like Turner. He's a terrific shot blocker, and he does do some things that most teams would like to have, including this one. But I think your point is valid. One of the questions going into the season was, could these two guys play together? Do their skills complement each other? And although there were times where they were very effective together, I still think that's a question that has yet to be answered. So it'll be interesting to see approach the offseason in terms of structuring their roster.
All right, we're talking with Mark Boyle. He's the radio voice of the Indiana Pacers. He's joining us here on Cavs HQ, presented by Sherwin-Williams. We'll have more from Mark right after this. Welcome back to Cavs HQ, presented by Sherwin-Williams. Tim Elkhorn, Jim Jones. Great to have Mark Boyle, the voice of the Indiana Pacers, joining us on this week's program. And Mark, you and Jim before the break were talking about play in the bubble. And of course, Jim and I weren't at the bubble as far as Cavaliers basketball was concerned. Now, I know you weren't there physically, but you had to call games. I'm curious. I'm sure Jim is too, and maybe the fans are. Boy, how challenging was that to call games that you're not physically right there at the floor?
It was challenging, and it was interesting. We did our broadcasts from a studio in our field house, and our behind-the-scenes people were terrific. They set us up with multiple monitors. We had real sound coming from the site in Orlando. And so from a technical standpoint, it wasn't that difficult, but what I found challenging and difficult, and I'd be willing to bet that if you asked the other guys who were doing games from down there, they would tell you the same thing. It was really difficult sitting in a room. It was just myself, our engineer, Pat Boylan, our studio guy, and Eddie Gill, who was, doing the analysis. And otherwise, it was an empty studio, and it was really hard to generate the same energy and enthusiasm that you would when you're in a building full of fans. I think we did okay with that and accomplished it at least to a degree, but the feel of the games themselves. Now, I didn't get this feeling when I watched other teams' games on television, but I did get it when doing our games from that empty studio. Boy, they seemed like scrimmages. Even the playoff games didn't feel the same when you were broadcasting them, although I will say, and I'd be curious as to what you guys thought about watching games. When I watched other teams' games, they did seem pretty much the same, but doing them was a little bit different.
Well, let me ask you this, Mark. And you can answer it or not. It's a pretty poignant question. If you think about it, should there be an asterisk next to the L.A. Lakers championship? 90 days in a bubble?
Well, that's a good question. And I could see that when I was in debate, Jim, when I was in high school, I spent some time doing debate. And this would be a perfect question for that because I think you could intelligently argue both sides of it.
Yep.
Yes, it's not the same. So from that standpoint, perhaps there's an asterisk. Would you put an asterisk in the lockout seasons for the same reasons? Fewer games? Maybe. Now, this was different beyond that, obviously. But there are challenges in the bubble, I think it's fair to say, that don't exist during a real NBA season. You're isolated. You're restricted as to what you can do. You really only see your own teammates. You don't see your family members. So there are other challenges. I don't know what side I fall on that question, but I think you could make an argument either way, don't you?
Yeah,
oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But last week, Mark, we had Chuck Swirsky on. Of course, you and Chuck know each other very well, and Bob McAdoo was on, and we were all talking about the fact that you do have to give an amazing amount of credit to the NBA as a whole. To pull off what they did down in Orlando was simply unbelievable.
Oh, for sure. And I was among the skeptics.
I applauded
the effort when they started, but I thought, wow, that's a long time to expect nothing to go wrong. And you had the stray incident where somebody had to be quarantined for whatever reason, but there were no positive tests. The playoffs were competitive. They were interesting. Yes, I think an A++++ is the grade I would give the NBA for that. It was remarkable.
Yeah, and you know what, Mark, and we're definitely in a new age when management and employees can work together for the common good, and I think that is the strength of Silver, and I'm sure you will agree at all the broadcast meetings we go to, he seems to have a realistic approach to working together and making this NBA work for everybody, and I've got to say, I take my hat off to him. And when I see him, I'm going to go up to him. I won't shake his hand, and maybe we'll do elbows, and we'll be distancing. But this is it's historically setting, I mean, he was the first. As soon as he heard that one of the players had gotten sick, what was it, Tim? Were we in Chicago at the time? Maybe March 5th or March 6th or something like that?
Yeah, we had flown back from Chicago. I know Indiana's last game, I believe, was against Boston, correct, Mark? As far as before COVID, yes.
Yeah, and he shut it down. He shut it down.
We were off the night that they started suspending games and ultimately announced that the season would at least temporarily halt. So we were at home. I distinctly remember it, as I'm sure we all do.
As we all do.
Yeah,
yes.
Sure.
Now, Mark, before we let you go, I did do a little research here. You are one multifaceted guy. I mean, you think, well, 32 years as the voice of the Pacers. You were involved with the U.S. Open chess tournament. You do stand-up comedy. And you perform with the Indianapolis Symphony. Now, my broadcast partner, Jim Jones, is just raving all the time about his musical ability. You know, he brings that bass on the road with us wherever we go. But you play with the Indianapolis Symphony.
Well,
now, what do you play?
I'm gonna clarify something here. It's true that I performed with the Symphony on multiple occasions. But I did spin that in such a way that you can interpret it any way you want. What I did with the symphony, they do. So you see where I'm going here.
Yeah.
They.
I think we're veering off into stand-up comedy here, right?
No, I did do stand-up comedy more than once. But here's what happened with the symphony. They do these themed concerts. For example, on the 4th of July, they'll do a patriotic concert. And I perform with them twice. During one of their patriotic concerts, I dressed up in a Civil War uniform and read Gettysburg Address while they played music. Okay. And then another time when they were doing a sports-themed concert, I dressed up in an old-time baseball uniform and read Casey at the Bat. So, yes, I performed with the symphony. It's true. There's no misstatement there. But if you assumed I played an instrument, that's on you.
Yeah, well, you know what they say about those who assume.
But I did do the other stuff, though, Tim, and you didn't even mention that I went piranha fishing and swam in the Amazon.
Well, you know, there was only so many things I could pull out of the media guide there, Mark. But all right, so U.S. Open chess tournament. Now, if you're out on the road, are you always asking guys with the Pacers, hey, who wants to take me on in chess, and is there a formidable foe?
You know, I used to back in the day, and you know who was a really, really good chess player? You guys will remember this guy. Vern Fleming was an outstanding chess player.
Vern?
Yeah.
Really?
Very good. Yeah. Yep. And he and I used to play on occasion, but I haven't played in a long time. I went to the U.S. Open in 96, and again, I did play in it, but it should be noted that you don't have to qualify. Anyone who wants to can play. And I had played extensively as a kid, and I wanted to see if I could play with elite players.
Sure.
So I went out there. It was in Arlington, Virginia. And I played several matches. I didn't fare particularly well, although I did take the Armed Services Champion to a draw. On the other hand, I was beaten by a 9-year-old kid. So,
Mark, you're ruining all these accolades that I had for you here.
Well, see, I'm a big believer in candor, Tim, and I normally let those statements sit and speak for themselves, but if you ask me, I've got to come clean.
Well, the producers through the window are telling me, checkmate. We're out of time, so.
I like it.
Mark.
Well played.
This has been a lot of fun. Great conversation. And, of course, we look forward to the day that we see each other in person, either at your beautiful arena or here at Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse. But we appreciate you spending the time with us.
Anytime, Tim. Always a pleasure.
Thank
Jim.
You,
thanks,
Mark.
Guys.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks, Mark. Mark Boyle, the longtime voice of the Indiana Pacers, joining us here on Cavs HQ, presented by Sherwin-Williams. We'll take a break, and we'll wrap it all up right after this. Welcome back to Cavs HQ, presented by Sherwin-Williams. Tim Elkhorn, Jim Jones. That was a fun show. Great big thank you to Bobby Dandridge and Mark Boyle for joining us as guests. And Jim, next week we've got a very special show. Next week it will start the 45th anniversary of the Miracle of Richfield year. So I'm sure we'll talk about this as the season unfolds. But boy, first of all, hard to believe that the Miracle year was 45 seasons ago. So we're going to delve into that next week on Cavs HQ.
Well, you know, Tim, I was a child prodigy, so I started that show at about six. You know, I started playing about 6 years old. I was just way ahead of my time. So it'll be 45 years?
Yeah, it was the 75-76 season, so this will be the 45th anniversary. So we've got some special guests lined up. Maybe we'll dig into the archives and pull out some highlights and have some fun with that. So I'm loving this, Jim. I'm having a good time. I hope you are, and the listeners are as well.
Yep, well, you make it work, babe. You, Marty, and Kirk, you guys make it work. And don't forget the big man, Leo.
Yeah, absolutely.
Appreciate it. All right.
So that's going to do it for this week's edition of Cavs HQ, presented by Sherwin-Williams. As Jim just mentioned, thanks to Marty Allen, Kurt McLaughlin, Leo Simone. Thanks to my broadcast partner and co-host, Jim Jones. Biggest thanks goes to you, the listeners. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll talk again next week on Cavs HQ, presented by Sherwin-Williams. Until then, so long, everybody.